so why did I play that for you? You have the poem or the lyrics right there. It was originally a poem. Now, some of you might actually already know this. Do you know who composed the music? Nietzsche. So you've just heard Nietzsche's music. For a while, Nietzsche wanted to be a composer. He's very musical. In fact, Nietzsche said that he thought philosophy and politics should be done like opera. It should be stirring. It should move you. It should be emotional. So think about that, and think about these lyrics as we're working through what kind of person Nietzsche is, what kind of philosopher he is. So I've got here an image that's Plato on the left, kind of pontificating or lecturing, and Nietzsche on the right, looking kind of tired and kind of bored. Maybe this is a look that's familiar to some of you. I don't know. Hopefully not. We're always interesting, right? Okay. So why do I have this? Nietzsche and Plato squaring off. And in addition, I have kind of a lot of frames going on here. So there's a frame around this picture, and a frame also kind of intersecting Nietzsche's head. Why do I have these? Last week, there was a lot of discussion of frames. Kevin talked a lot about frames with relation to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And today we're going to talk about frames again, because Nietzsche really resists frames and framing. He resists classifications. In fact, it's hard to even classify what kind of intellectual he is. Is he a philosopher? Well, sort of, but he was famously anti-philosophical, though we in philosophy often like to credit him as one of our own. Was he involved in comparative literature? Yes, definitely, though again, it's a little bit problematic since he seems to bring philosophy and comparative literature together a lot of the time. Is he a poet? Some philosophers say that he is a poet more than he's a philosopher, that he plays with words much like a poet. And you also now know that he was interested in music and also tried to be a composer, though eventually he decided he wasn't very good at it and he gave up composition and became a music critic instead. So there's a bit of a resisting of classification for Nietzsche, and he himself doesn't like to have ideas classified or framed. So he'll play a lot with ideas, and as one of my students asked me last week while reading Nietzsche, he'll come out in admiration and criticizing something at the same time, professing love and hate for something at the same time, making you wonder, what's the deal with this guy? What does he really think? Why doesn't he just come right out and tell us? So that's one reason for the framing. There's another reason for the framing, which I guess I'm going to own up to right now. And that's that as I was trying to design this, I designed it in a new format. I have presented using this software before, but this is the first time I've done kind of a long 2-hour presentation using this software. And once I was finished, I realized the frames really cluttered everything up. And actually, there was a way to do this having invisible frames. Too late now. But maybe I did it on purpose. Maybe subconsciously I did it on purpose so that we could discuss Nietzsche with relation to framing. That's what I'm going to go with. Cool. You can all go with it with me, right? All right. Okay. So why do I have Nietzsche and Plato kind of squaring off here? I will explain the reason for that in a moment. Here we are, inside Plato's mind, a window into Plato's thoughts, from a memory of what happened way last semester. When was that? Like October. Just in case you don't remember, this is the same image I actually used in my Plato lecture. What is Plato all about? Plato is about finding foundations, right? If we get outside of the cave and see the way the world really is, we will know the good, and knowing the good means conforming to the good. An anchor and a foundation and a direction for our actions. And if you remember, Plato also said, once we have the Kallipolis working, there's nothing left for us to do. We can rest in this Kallipolis and nothing will have to change and no progress needs to be made. So there will be a stillness and an anchor coming out of Plato's philosophy. Whoops. Next. Okay. What does Nietzsche think about all of this? Nietzsche is profoundly anti-foundational. So when he looks at a structure like Plato's that purports to give us a foundation, a form of the good from which we don't have to deviate and after which nothing has to change, he doesn't see an anchor and a stillness. Instead, he sees stagnation. If there's no movement, if there's no change, we're just going to end up in this kind of stagnant, boring world. And we'll talk a lot about why Nietzsche thinks that's a problem. So in this text that you were asked to read for today, you'll find that Nietzsche has given you three essays. Each essay is dealing with a topic, sort of. One explores the origins of the word good. The second one explores the origins of guilt or bad conscience. And finally, we look at the origins of ideals, or Nietzsche begins the third essay with the question, what is the meaning of aesthetic ideals? Each essay is centered somewhat around this idea, and yet things that happen in each essay support and clarify things that are happening in the other two essays. So there's no foundation here, but there's a lot of connection happening. Unlike, say, Plato, who began with a question and then dug down until he could provide us with a foundation, Nietzsche isn't going to do that. Or like Hobbes, who began his work by giving us a bunch of definitions and then working axiomatically from the definitions to build arguments that rested on you accepting the definitions. Nietzsche isn't going to do that. So there's no kind of foundation happening here at all. His work is anti-foundationalist, both in content, he's going to advocate for a loss of foundations, and in structure. The way he writes is profoundly anti-foundationalist. So that's part of the reason I call Nietzsche the anti-philosopher. But he's also a bit of an anti-person in general. He was anti-against the philosophical system, anti-academia. He actually wrote a book once called Antichrist. The word Antichrist appears in the Genealogy of Morals. So you're going to see this anti, this reactionary, this resistance and pushback a lot as you read through Nietzsche's work. So there isn't going to be a foundation. Instead, there's going to be a lot of motion, which I hope will explain to you why I've chosen to do this presentation in a prezi. There's going to be a lot of motion even as I take you through this, because it's a bit of a struggle to figure out how to represent in a linear lecture style a work that is profoundly anti-linear, and how to talk you through something that is anti-foundationalist. So I'm trying to represent that right here. Hopefully we won't get motion sick. See how it goes. So far, so good? Okay. Might get worse towards the end, but we'll see. All right, so if we're not going to have a foundation, it would be really good if we had kind of a sense about what it is we're doing in this text. So the text is titled The Genealogy of Morals, or sometimes The Genealogy of Morality, and whether we translate it as morals or morality might actually matter. That might be something you want to talk about in your seminar. So what exactly is a genealogy? Well, a genealogy is a type of history, a family tree. It's something that traces back origins and tells you how you came to be where you are. So it's going to contextualize morality, not providing us a foundational, never-changing anchor, but a history of how it is we came to the position we're in now, now being Nietzsche's time, though you might think a lot of it still applies even today. So I have here my comic from Oedipus, looking into his own genealogy. I warned you, Oedipus, not everybody likes what they find when they trace their family tree. And this will also, Nietzsche thinks, be true as we work through the genealogy of morality, that we might come up with things as we dig through this genealogy of how we came to have the morals we have that we don't necessarily like. So why do we need a genealogy? Nietzsche tells us in the preface, we are unknown to ourselves, we men of knowledge, and with good reason. We have never sought ourselves. How could it happen that we should ever find ourselves? This might seem odd. We have never sought ourselves. But Nietzsche thinks we are actually masters of self-deception, that we are hiding from ourselves. So I have this guy hiding in a box. It seemed appropriate at the time. So we're hiding from ourselves because we don't really want to know or admit things about ourselves. We hide truths about the origins of morality because uncovering these truths would involve uncovering things about ourselves that we don't want to face. In fact, Nietzsche thinks that we set up foundations in part as a way of avoiding looking at these dark truths about ourselves. Why? Because a foundation means you don't have to look beyond it. If you have a foundation, you're done. So I'm going to tell you a really quick anecdote of something that happened when I was in grad school. I was doing my master's, and there was a guy studying his master's with me, and he's writing his dissertation, or his thesis, and it's really, really frustrating, which maybe you can I don't know, relate to. Because as he's writing his thesis, his supervisor keeps coming back and goes, okay, wait, no, you need an argument for that. You can't just state it. Okay, what are your reasons for this? Okay, what is supporting this claim? And one day we were sitting around having a beer, kind of complaining about our profs, as you might, I don't know. And he said, you know what? I'm just gonna write my thesis statement and then put, it's a brute fact. It's a brute fact. You can't look behind a brute fact. I don't have to argue before it. It's a fact. All investigations stop there. Yeah, that didn't work so well. Don't do it. It won't work. But it does kind of show psychologically the way in which foundations operate on us, which is once you set up what you claim is a foundational truth, all investigation gets to stop. And so Nietzsche thinks we use these foundational truths as ways of avoiding investigation because we might uncover things we don't like. Okay, so we're not going to have any foundations, but here's something like a thesis, sort of, kind of. Okay, so in the introduction, in the preface, Nietzsche says, I understood the ever-spreading morality of pity that had seized even on philosophers and made them ill as the most sinister symptom of a European culture that had itself become sinister. Perhaps as its bypass to a new Buddhism for Europeans, to nihilism. Oh, this is gonna be a serious text. All right, so what's happening here? Well, it looks like we're gonna have an origins or a genealogy of morality explaining how we came to have the modern morality we do, why this modern morality that we have is making us ill, is making us sick, how this illness might be connected to nihilism. What is nihilism? What is nihilism? It came up a few times in the text, so if you come across a word you don't understand, you should probably look it up. Anyone? Yeah?
Belief that there's no meaning in anything.
Yeah, belief in no meaning, or belief in nothing. Nietzsche will sometimes also call it a will to nothing. A belief in no meaning, no purpose, no values. So how is this illness, this morality, connected to nihilism? And then sort of a suggestion about what we should do about it. Although this last part won't be fully fleshed out in the genealogy. A lot of the legwork about what we should do about the morality that we're stuck in is covered in another text that Nietzsche wrote, another few texts, a little bit in Beyond Good and Evil, and a lot in a text called Thus Spake Zarathustra. So if you're interested in what we should do about it, according to Nietzsche, you can go look at those texts. Okay. So where do we begin with this anti-foundationalist guy? Thought bubbles. Let's start. I want to invite you to look at the end of the first essay, near the end of the first essay, page 46, and what we call aphorism 14. We'll come to aphorisms in a minute. So it's numbered, paragraph number 14. Why do I want you to look here? Throughout this course, we've had a lot of discussion of caves and enclosed spaces and light. So we had the Cyclops in a cave. We had Grendel in a cave, or Grendel's mom in a cave, I guess. The dragon and light in a cave. Plato's cave, obviously, which I have up here. Exit the cave, see the forms. There's been a lot of discussion of caves. Robinson Crusoe spent a lot of time building himself a really comfortable cave. So we've had a lot of invitations into caves and exiting caves. And something kind of like that happens here with Nietzsche on page 46. Would anyone like to take a look into the secret of how ideals are made on Earth? Who has the courage? Very well. Here is a point we can see through into this dark workshop. So you're being invited to look into a workshop and see where ideals are made. But wait a moment or two, Mr. Rash and Curious. Your eyes must first get used to this false iridescent light. This might sound a little bit like Plato. Plato said when you exited the cave, your eyes would be dazzled and you wouldn't be able to make sense of it. And Nietzsche's saying, as you look into how ideals come into being, slow down because your eyes will be dazzled. You can't trust your eyes. And then he says, all right, now speak. And in one of the weirdest things I think I've read in a long time, not only does Nietzsche invite you, the reader, to enter this workshop and speak, but he then goes so far as to put words into your mouth. I mean, that just makes him a warm and fuzzy guy, right? Okay, speak. And what do you say? I see nothing, but I hear the more. So you don't see anything. In fact, there's over and over and over again a repetition that you cannot trust your eyes. Do not trust what you see. Don't pay attention to what you see. Instead, listen. There is a soft, wary, malignant muttering and whispering coming from all corners and nooks. It seems to me one is lying. A saccharine sweetness clings to every sound, this sickly sweet lie. Weakness is being lied into something meritorious. No doubt of it, it is just as you said. And then further on, you have a lot to say, as it turns out, you the reader, with Nietzsche putting words in your mouth. Further on, you cry out, enough, enough, bad air, bad air. This workshop where ideals are manufactured, it seems to me it stinks of so many lies. You are repelled by these ideals, by this workshop. Why does it stink? He uses this over and over again. Enough, enough, bad air, as though things were so stagnant and rotting that they stunk, as though we'd lost so much movement and motion that everything is just stale. So have you ever smelled like stagnant water? It's pretty grim. I don't recommend it. Anyway, so there's an idea here that the loss of motion is just making things reek. Okay. So I want to give a little bit of advice, perhaps, on how to read this text, because this is an anti-foundational text, and it is a text that doesn't have kind of one linear argument. In fact, it's a non-linear text entirely. Obviously, as with every text, we want you to read and reread. And John, I think, back when, I think it was Columbus, talked a little bit about how to read texts and reading three times. Obviously, all that stuff still applies. With this text, I also want you to get into groups, not just in your seminars, but maybe over Twitter or over Facebook, and talk about what you think is going on. Because this text is not going to offer you a lot of arguments. It's written in the style of aphorisms. What is an aphorism? Yeah?
It's like a short, pithy statement that contains the argument.
Yeah. So the genealogy is actually the least aphoristic of Nietzsche's aphorism texts, because these aphorisms often are very, very long. So there is kind of an argument being developed. But even so, he still leaves a lot of the work up to the reader. It's supposed to be witty, pithy, and engaging. But the engagement really depends on you engaging with the text, not just reading and understanding, but considering and discussing from different angles. As well, don't just try and figure out what's happening in each individual essay, but connect the essays to each other. Things that happen in one essay will support or contradict or shed light on things that happen in another essay. So you need to be able to bounce back and forth between the three essays. And all of this basically comes down to me asking you to play with the text. Play seriously with the text. What do I mean by that? In Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche has an aphorism where he says, a man's maturity consists in having found again the seriousness one had as a child at play. The seriousness one had as a child at play. That might sound a little bit oxymoronic to you, perhaps. Because don't we think of children as kind of whimsical and innocent and free? Okay, but I want you really to think about it. Think about when you were like hanging out in a playground at recess and you were playing. Because if you were anything like me, and maybe you weren't, those games really mattered. And if someone broke the rules, oh my God. Does this sound a bit familiar? I mean, games matter a lot to children when they engage in the games. It's not just a pastime. It's very, very serious. You are creating something, creating a world, creating a game. And it matters that everybody interact in the creative process. And yet it is just a game. And when that recess bell rings and you have to go inside, you discard the game and you go inside. So Nietzsche wants you to be able to play seriously with this text. While you're engaging with it, make it matter. But also be able to kind of step away with it and put it down. Don't get obsessive. Cool. There are a few things I want to draw your attention to as you work through this text. Themes that come up over and over again. Some of them I've already mentioned. There will be an emphasis on motion instead of on foundation or stagnation. Nietzsche is a thinker who moves a lot. Sometimes you'll read through an aphorism and the next aphorism will seem to have very little to do with the one before. He's making a jump and he expects you to follow him in this jump. He jumps around, he moves a lot. The text is full of motion instead of stagnation, instead of foundation. Also, think about the emphasis he puts on listening instead of seeing, on not trusting your eyes. Remember that Nietzsche was a composer and that he thought philosophy should be done like opera. So listening matters. And finally, Nietzsche will put a stress on truths. See the S's in red to try and draw attention to it. Truths, plural, instead of foundational truth, like the form of the good or the eternal truth. Yeah?
So are you saying that possibly reading this aloud might help?
Definitely. Yep, and Nietzsche is sometimes taken to be a bit of a poet. Some of the things here in Kaufman's translation are quite engaging, and if you read them aloud, you'd hear them differently. Sure. So those are a few things I want you to watch for. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about the author persona here. Okay. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that is present. Thank you, Kevin. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Nietzsche the person, and why I'm spending some time discussing Nietzsche the person will make sense, especially as we work through the genealogy, why it is you need to know something about him. So if you're anything like me, the first time I read Nietzsche, and thank you. Oh, things I forgot.
Anti-Nietzsche.
Yes, it's jarring. So the first time you read Nietzsche, if you're anything like me, you might have felt like somebody was standing about this close to you and just kind of shouting at you, because that's how it felt to me. He was so aggressive and so in my face, and in that one passage I've read you so far from the Genealogy of Morals, he is actually so aggressive that he puts words in your mouth. You, the reader, are told what you think. This is an invasive and aggressive writer. In fact, many people will say it is impossible to be indifferent to Nietzsche. You might like him, you might hate him, but he is provoking a reaction of some kind, forcefully. So we have in the preface, if this book is incomprehensible to anyone and jars his ears, as maybe that buzzing was jarring your ears, the fault, it seems to me, is not necessarily mine. No, it's not my fault, it's your fault. You didn't read my text carefully enough. You didn't play with it seriously enough. Okay, this isn't exactly a way to win your reader over. So I hope you can see that he is aggressive and he expects a lot from you engaging with this text. He is also a very suspicious writer. He's suspicious of any foundations. He's suspicious of other people's claims. He will criticize people and say they are concealing things behind what they say. And so he's a deeply suspicious thinker and writer. In addition, and I think these last two are the things that make him the hardest to read, Nietzsche is a rank elitist. He thinks some people are better than other people, and he does rank people. And finally, you may have noticed this, he pretty much hates everyone. So as you read through this text, you will find Nietzsche saying horrible things about Judaism, Christianity, women, though that's less in this text, but much, much more in other texts, Germans, the English, etc., etc., etc. There is a lot of hate and loathing coming out of these texts. And yet again, because Nietzsche doesn't like to be compartmentalized, he will also express admiration for people he has just expressed hatred towards. So that's something to think about, as this is the kind of persona he's presenting. So who was Nietzsche? He lived from 1844 to 1900. Here is a Yunish picture of him. And Nietzsche was born and raised mainly in a house full of women. So that might explain some of his hatred towards women, people have thought. I don't know. I guess it depends on the type of women he was raised around. So about the time Nietzsche was 5, his father died. We're not entirely sure what his father died of, but it seems his father had suffered from a mental illness for many, many years, and Nietzsche was deeply concerned that he would also contract this illness. So his father died when he was around 5, his brother died shortly thereafter, and Nietzsche was raised by his mother and his grandmother, and the only other person in the house was his sister. So he was raised in a house full of women, and he was haunted by this image of his father. In fact, he says he used to have a recurring dream when he was young that he was lying on his father's tombstone and his father's hand came out of the ground and pulled Nietzsche under. So his father was literally haunting him in his sleep. Nietzsche had illness through much of his life, and this is especially true in his childhood, that when he went away to boarding school, we have a lot of letters that he would write home to his sister complaining of stomach ailments and migraines, and this would continue for the rest of his life. He went to university interested in studying theology and in studying music. He also went on to study philosophy and philology. Philology being love of words. So he's very interested in words and the origins of words and interactions between words. For a while, he tried to become a comparative literature scholar. Then he got much more interested in philosophy. But he still wrote kind of from the influence of comparative literature. So philosophers didn't quite know what he was doing because they thought he wasn't doing philosophy. And people in comparative lit departments didn't know quite what he was doing because he was writing about philosophical concepts, but in a comparative lit way. So he had a little bit of trouble finding an audience to listen to him. And yet, by 1868, when he was 24 years old, he was offered the chair at the University of Basel. This was a huge deal. He was very, very young. I mean, by today's standards, it would be unheard of. But even then, this was remarkable. And yet, when he entered the university, by all accounts, he was extremely unpopular. So we have reports that the first year his classes filled up. He had 20 in his seminars that held 20 students. The next year, that dropped to 8, and the year after, it dropped to 6. So he had very few people attending his classes, and the more he published, the more people seemed to get scared and kind of run away from him. This was very distressing for him. Okay, so in 1878, Nietzsche was suffering from severe migraines and stomach problems, and he could no longer work. And he ended up having to leave the university, quit his job, took his pension, and he became one of the university's biggest critics now, criticizing institutionalized academia from the outside. What did he do? From 1878 until 1888, Nietzsche stayed in spas and bed and breakfasts, traveling around Europe, mostly in Switzerland and Germany, trying to find some kind of environment that was conducive to his health. And he wrote like crazy. He was the first philosopher to write completely on a typewriter rather than writing out his ideas longhand. The idea was supposed to be that typing on a typewriter would not aggravate his migraines as much as writing longhand. So he carried his typewriter all around the countryside with him. And he would stay in bed and breakfast. He was extremely solitary at this time. And he wrote like crazy. January 1889. Nietzsche looks out the window and he sees a cabbie beating a horse. This is a horse-drawn carriage, and the cabbie is whipping the horse. Reportedly, Nietzsche ran out into the street, flung his arms around the horse's neck, and screamed, "Stop! Stop! You're beating Christ! You're beating Dionysus!" This drew a crowd, understandably. People kind of gathered around, and Nietzsche promptly fainted. Fortunately, some people in the crowd happened to know where Nietzsche was staying, so they picked him up and they carried him home and laid him down on the couch and tried to revive him. Once Nietzsche was revived, he jumped up, danced a jig, ran over to his piano, and started playing music. People were getting kind of nervous. They couldn't make any sense out of him. They couldn't get him to slow down and explain. They called his mother, and shortly after that, it was decided that Nietzsche was mad. Nietzsche had gone mad. From January 1889 until his death in 1900, reportedly Nietzsche never spoke another comprehensible word. He never wrote anything else. He never published anything else. From 1878 to 1888, he published 13 books. He self-published them. No publishing company was interested in him. And they sold incredibly poorly. However, after January 1889, Nietzsche became famous. And his books started selling pretty well. At this point, Nietzsche fell under the care of his sister. So she was looking after him. She also was controlling all the publications of his books. She would dress him in robes. He was in a wheelchair. He didn't walk. You can actually find footage on YouTube of Nietzsche's last days if you're interested. There is a film of him in about the last year of his life. And so you can see him in this wheelchair. She would dress him in robes. She would wheel him out onto the veranda of their house, and people would gather and ask questions. And Elizabeth Forrester Nietzsche would interpret Nietzsche's responses and give them back to the people. So Nietzsche had become a seer or an icon, and people read his work and engaged with his work and came to see him as though he were some kind of prophet. What happened? There are lots of speculations about what happened and how Nietzsche came to be classified as mad. One is that his father's mental illness really did catch up with him, that he did contract the same whatever it was disorder that his father had. Another one is that while Nietzsche was in university, he visited a brothel and may have contracted syphilis, which went untreated, and that it had finally resurfaced. Another speculation is that while Nietzsche was serving 2 years mandatory military service, he fell off a horse and cracked his skull, and that he may have suffered long-term brain damage that didn't resurface for several years. And one that is quite popular in philosophy departments, though I can't figure out why, is that perhaps he just did too much philosophy. Maybe he thought himself into a bad place. But here's another suggestion I want to give to you, that there is a likeness or a similarity between Nietzsche and Robert Walton. Here's a letter from Nietzsche to his sister. This is 1886, right around the time The Genealogy of Morals came out. "My health is really quite normal. Only my soul is so sensitive and so full of longing for good friends of my own kind. Get me a small circle of men who will listen to me and understand me, and I shall be cured." And a fictional letter, which should be familiar to you, from Robert Walton. "I greatly need a friend who would have sense enough not to despise me as a romantic and affection enough for me to regulate my mind." Who's Robert Walton? Come on. Frankenstein, thank you. He's your first narrator writing letters to his sister from Frankenstein. So you might wonder, in what ways are Nietzsche like Walton? Or in what ways is Nietzsche like Victor? He traveled, he isolated himself, and he searched beneath foundations. Perhaps he searched for things he shouldn't have been uncovering. How did Nietzsche fare in history? As I said, after 1889, Nietzsche fell under the care of his sister. Man, Kevin is popular. It's okay, you turned off the sound earlier, so I think we're equal now. Okay, so how did Nietzsche fare in history? Nietzsche's sister not only was in charge of Nietzsche's care, but she was also in charge of all of Nietzsche's works. Before Nietzsche suffered from whatever he suffered and ended up classified as mad, before that happened, he had been working on what he thought was going to be his greatest and most cumulative work, The Will to Power. In fact, he'd been obsessively working on this book for about 4 years. He'd written and rewritten it, and it never came out quite right, and reportedly he threw one copy of The Will to Power into a lake. He was so frustrated with it, and so he couldn't get it to work. Elizabeth Forster Nietzsche took Nietzsche's notes on The Will to Power, and she edited them. She was married to a member of the Nazi Party, and she was acquainted with Hitler and a huge supporter of the Nazi movement. And so after Nietzsche's death, Elizabeth Forster Nietzsche published The Will to Power in an edited form, where she emphasized all the hatred he displayed towards Judaism, and she eliminated any of the admiration he had towards Judaism, and also any of the hatred he displayed towards the German people. And so she sent a significantly altered version of The Will to Power out into the public. She also may have edited some of his other works, and all these things were being published in support of the Nazi Party. And here we have a picture of Elizabeth Forster Nietzsche in the middle, shaking hands with Adolf Hitler. In fact, Hitler made Elizabeth Forster Nietzsche's death and funeral a matter of national importance. So how is Nietzsche remembered in history? After Nietzsche went mad, and even after his death, there was this kind of idea that he was a seer or a prophet or holy, and he was tied quite tightly with the Nazi Party. After the end of World War II, it was no longer acceptable to study Nietzsche inside academia. Engaging with Nietzsche's works at all was completely taboo. And this went on for quite a while, until your editor, Walter Kaufmann, pretty much by himself, made it acceptable to study Nietzsche again. He went back to the original German notes that Nietzsche had made for The Will to Power and to the original texts that Nietzsche had published himself, and he translated them into English, and he also republished them in German so that you could engage with Nietzsche's work as he wrote it, rather than through the filter of his sister. So Walter Kaufmann rehabilitated Nietzsche's work and made it acceptable for Nietzsche to be studied again in philosophy, and this was in the late 60s. Before that, nobody had really been engaging with Nietzsche's work. In fact, some people say Kaufmann rehabilitated Nietzsche a little bit too much. That now, when people criticize Nietzsche, the usual explanation is you haven't really understood him. So you can think about that. Although, actually, I shouldn't say now, in about the past 10 to 15 years, there's been more criticism again. Nietzsche today. Is that coming out? Oh, it's a little bit dark. That's Lex Luthor from Superman. How is Nietzsche represented today? Usually in popular culture, Nietzsche is represented as somebody who's dangerous. We usually see his words and his ideas unreflectively put in the mouths of intelligent, evil people. So here's Lex Luthor saying, he was given a copy of The Will to Power for his birthday. Behold the Superman, man is someone to be overcome. And the Superman, or in German, the Übermensch, is one of Nietzsche's big ideas. It comes up a little bit in this text, but not as much. So today we see Nietzsche in two kind of ways in popular culture. Either you see kind of angsty teenagers with black turtlenecks reading Nietzsche, and that's supposed to show that they're deep. Or you see Nietzsche displayed as kind of this villain. In fact, today, Nietzsche is one of the widely engaged with philosophers of all time. Which is, of course, why we want to claim him a philosopher. You can buy Nietzsche's famous aphorism, God is dead, on a t-shirt. In fact, you can buy one that says God is dead on the front, and on the back it says Nietzsche is dead. And Nietzsche has his own wall cat. It's pretty amazing. So he is one of the most widely engaged philosophers and widely read philosophers of all time at this point. But people don't often play with his ideas very seriously. So this is kind of a superficial engagement that is happening. And today, I want to try and play with his ideas seriously. So here again is kind of my visual, and Nietzsche wouldn't like sight, but oh well, my visual map of the three essays. And I'm going to take us through the three essays, but there is so much happening in each of these essays that I'm only able to touch on a few major themes in each. So don't think after the end of this that there's nothing more to be discussed, which I know you wouldn't think anyway. And as I take us through these three essays, I'm going to bounce between the three as well a little bit, especially as I get to the second and third, showing connections and the ways in which each essay supports the other. So let's begin with The Origins of Good, the first essay. Nietzsche begins the first essay with kind of a backhanded admiration towards English philosophers. If you remember this. Oh, the English philosophers are great because they totally started their analysis of the origins of good in the right place. I mean, they suck, but they're okay. So it's kind of this backhanded admiration. When he's talking about English philosophers, you might wonder, who is he talking about? There actually have been quite a number of English philosophers. It seems from the context that he is likely talking about two groups of English philosophers, empiricists and utilitarians. So you've met a somewhat of an empiricist in the philosopher Hobbes, who styles himself as a type of empiricist, an early empiricist. Here I'm going to introduce you to a utilitarian. That's his picture in the corner. This is Jeremy Bentham. Jeremy Bentham, writing around Nietzsche's time, came up with the principle of utility. What is the principle of utility? Here's Jeremy Bentham's quotation on it. The principle of utility approves or disapproves of every action whatsoever according to the tendency which it appears to have to augment or diminish the happiness of the party whose interest is in question.
Whoa.
Okay. So what's that saying? It's a pretty simple argument. Jeremy Bentham says, things that are good are things that tend to augment happiness, and things that are bad are things that tend to reduce the amount of happiness. So if, and this is the person who matters, the person who the action is done to. So since I'm channeling my Plato lecture a little bit anyway, let's go back to that example. If you gave me a cookie, that would be good, because it would augment my happiness, especially if it's a cookie I like chocolate chip or something. However, if you offered me a cookie and then ate it in front of me, that would diminish my happiness. So that would be bad, not good. So Jeremy Bentham says, okay, where do I find the origins of good and bad? I'm not going to look behind the world like Plato did. I'm not going to look for some form. Instead, I'm going to look in the world. Nietzsche supports that. That's awesome. Nietzsche thinks looking behind the world is setting up these fictional foundations, which we're just doing to avoid knowing ourselves and avoid painful truths. So it's good that Bentham is actually engaging in the world. But Nietzsche thinks Bentham's mistake was in assuming that the way we use good and bad now is the way in which these terms have always been used, assuming a staticness about these terms. That's static, that's stagnant. Nietzsche says that's probably not the case. Probably these words have meant different things in different times. So the English philosophers are headed on the wrong road to discovering the origin of good. The signpost to the right road was for me the question, what was the real designation for good coined in the various languages? So he's going to look back and see the way in which good was used in the past. What did it really mean to call something good? I found they all led back to the same conceptual transformation, that everywhere, noble, aristocratic, in the social sense, is the basic concept from which good necessarily developed. So good meant whatever was noble. Whatever the nobles did, I'm a noble walking around and I'm pretty good. And where did bad come from? A development which always runs parallel with that other in which common, plebeian, low are finally transformed into the concept bad. So good referred to nobility and bad referred to kind of everyone else, the commoners. And this, says Nietzsche, is the origins of the word good. So how come that's not how we use the word good today? Nietzsche says because there's been an inversion of values. So imagine that you are a commoner living among all these nobles who walk around and they're like, yeah, I'm good, I'm awesome, I'm the noble. And you, you're common, you're bad. I mean, you're not, you know, evil or anything, but you're just not good. Well, how would you feel about that? You might think, screw that. Screw you. I'm not bad. You're bad. Take that, nobles. In fact, Nietzsche says it isn't exactly the commoners or the slaves that did this, but rather the priests of the commoners or the slaves that didn't like being told by the nobles that they were bad. And so we get an inversion of values. Not just an inversion, but an intensification. It's not just, hey, I'm not bad. You're bad. In fact, you're evil. Yeah. Take that. Okay, so Nietzsche tells us the slave revolt in morality begins with resentment. Itself becomes creative and gives birth to values. So the slave morality begins with this reaction. And throughout the text, you're going to see the French word resentment here to represent this reaction. The reason for this is that in German, Nietzsche didn't have a word that he could use to talk about resentment. It wasn't there. It wasn't available to him. So Nietzsche, in his resourcefulness and his playfulness, pulled a word from French and used it in his text. So Walter Kaufmann, our editor, says when he was thinking about translating this, he could have chosen to translate it directly into resentment. That's what Nietzsche's talking about. He's talking about the resentment of the commoners, of the slaves. But if he had translated it straight as resentment, you wouldn't have this constant reminder that Nietzsche is pulling a word that is not there in German language. So he's left it as the French and he's italicized it to draw your attention to the fact that Nietzsche's using a category that isn't available in the German language. Okay, so the slave revolt in morality begins with resentment, itself becomes creative and gives birth to values. So it's a reaction, it's resentment. While every noble morality develops from a triumphant affirmation of itself, I'm pretty great, Slave morality from the outset says no to what is outside, what is different, what is not itself. And this no is its creative deed. So while noble morality begins with, I'm pretty great, you're not so great, I guess. Slave morality begins with a reaction. No, you're bad. Oh, and I'm good, I guess, as an afterthought. So it's a reactionary morality instead of noble morality, which is an affirmation morality. This is supposed to be somewhat historical. He's giving you a genealogy or an origins, sort of. So where is this history coming from? Nietzsche tells us that he thinks that with the Jews begins the slave revolt in morality, a revolt which has a history of 2,000 years behind it, and which we no longer see because it has become victorious. If we no longer see it, Nietzsche thinks it is transparent for us now. Because we no longer see it, we can avoid actually noticing that good once meant something different. And that's what allows philosophers like Jeremy Bentham to set up arguments that support our common understanding of good. We no longer see it because it's ubiquitous. It's so pervasive that you don't even notice it, he says. So with the Jews begins the slave revolt in morality. In fact, not strictly speaking with the Jews, but with Judaism under the Roman Empire. So we have noble morality represented by the Romans, and slave morality represented by the Jews, but more specifically by the emergence of Christianity. In fact, kind of embodied in Jesus Christ, we see this slave morality. So here's the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor. The poor would be the commoners. And the Sermon on the Mount is telling you, blessed are the poor. It's okay to be poor. Poor is great. Why? For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Forget the nobles who are rich. They're not going to inherit the kingdom of heaven. The poor are. Blessed are the meek. It's okay if you're common and therefore you have to be meek because the nobles are kind of strutting around. Why? For they shall inherit the earth. So it's a morality that glorifies the roles and the responsibilities and the characteristics that are already part of the slaves and the commoners, and that vilifies the characteristics of the nobles. And it's important to draw this distinction here, that there is a vilification, according to Nietzsche, going on, whether you agree with him or not. How different the words bad and evil are, although they are both apparently the opposite of the same concept good. But it is not the same concept good. One should ask rather precisely, who is evil in the sense of morality of resentment? The answer, in all strictness, is precisely the good man of the other morality, precisely the noble, powerful man, the ruler, but dyed in another color, interpreted in another fashion, seen in another way by the venomous eye of resentment. So slave morality, according to Nietzsche, is a morality of hate and resentment. It's a reactionary morality, and it's masquerading as a morality of love and forgiveness. So again, he's asking you to look beneath what you take to be the common or foundational truth. And you can see why he expects people to react badly towards this, as he tells us that slave morality is a morality of hatred and resentment. Okay, but so what? So slave morality reacts against noble morality, and we end up in this situation where what used to be good is now evil, and what used to be bad is now good. Does it really matter? Why do we need to know about this? Well, Nietzsche thinks, in fact, it does matter, because he thinks that this morality is not good for the human species. We'll talk more about that, especially as we work through the second and third essays. We can see nothing today that wants to grow greater. Together with the fear of man, we have also lost our love for him, our reverence for him, our hopes for him, even the will to him. The sight of man now makes us weary. What is nihilism today if not that? We are weary of man. This may not make a lot of sense coming out of the first essay, but there's a lot more support for this statement in the second and the third essay. And so we will come back to this statement more than once as we work through the next two essays. But what I want you to take away right now is that Nietzsche thinks this reactionary morality will eventually lead us to nihilism, leading us to nihilism through weariness and nausea, as he said at other places too. Okay, so we have two sets of values on the table at this point, noble morality and slave morality. And in fact, There could be many, many more, since Nietzsche has illustrated for us that there are at least two ways in which the word good has been used historically. This opens up a possibility that there could be many ways of understanding the word good, none of them being, strictly speaking, correct or true in the sense of the one truth, the Platonic type of truth. How are we supposed to decide? If we don't have a foundation, how are we supposed to decide? I mean, it was easy for Plato. You get out of the cave, you see the good. There's no decision that has to happen about which type of values you're going to have. There it is, blinding you, done. But if we have a plurality of values, how do we choose? This is another slide we're going to come back to more than once. The question, what is the value of this or that table of values and morals, should be viewed from the most diverse perspectives. For the problem, value for what, cannot be examined too subtly. I want you to remember this. In the absence of foundations, and Nietzsche is an anti-foundationalist thinker, whenever someone puts their idea, their system of values, their thoughts on the table, the next question should always be, okay, but why do we want that? Value for what? What is that doing for us? What's really going on here? Why are you putting forward this system of values? In the absence of a foundation, or when we look under the foundation and find out it's not really a foundation, suddenly this question is open. And in addition, Nietzsche has said that we have to look at this from diverse perspectives. We need a lot of people, a lot of different perspectives looking at this question. We need a conversation. We need to listen, not just to look. Okay, so the origins of good, to kind of sum up here. These origins, the origin of good and evil, came out of a noble morality. This makes it contextual and historical. He can tell you a story about how we came to the place we came to. You may not buy the story, but that's what he's trying to do. Also remember that while Nietzsche is and will continue to be critical of slave morality, he is also critical of noble morality. Noble morality is the affirmative morality. It's the one that came out and said, hey, I'm good, and by consequence, all the rest of you are bad. It's the morality that the slaves are reacting against. And so Nietzsche is also critical of noble morality because it created an environment in which slave morality was basically inevitable. In fact, fate and inevitability will have a lot to play in Nietzsche's argument. Okay, so from here, I'm going to move on to the next two essays. But I think before I do that, it's probably a good place to take a 10 or a 12-minute break. So I'll see you back here in like 12 minutes. Thanks.